Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the December 5th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is a Christmas scene. I can't tell quite where it's set, but we have President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in front of a Christmas tree. Vladimir's sitting down in a red chair. Trump is happily handing him a present with Ukrainian colors on it and a bow, and it says, "To Vlad." There's a window, and we see Volodymyr Zelensky peering through the window with a concerned look on his face. Headline is, "A Gift to Russia, the Peace Plan Putin May Not Accept." That is our first main story, and we'll start with that. Ukraine and Rubio rewrite Russia's peace plan. What happened? After eliminating multiple Russian demands from a peace plan backed by President Trump, U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators agreed this week in Geneva on the framework for a deal to end the Ukraine war. But Russia's acceptance appeared unlikely. The framework is a heavily revised version of the 28-point peace plan that emerged last week from a secret meeting between White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, and Russian negotiator Kirill Dmitriev. The plan set off a firestorm when it was leaked, with Ukrainian and European officials and many U.S. lawmakers criticizing it as a surrender requiring no concessions from Moscow. It would have forced Ukraine to cede not only Russian-occupied regions, but territory it still controls in the Donbas, reduced and capped the size of its military, and barred Ukraine from NATO membership and having NATO peacekeepers on its soil. Trump issued an ultimatum to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to accept the deal or continue to fight his little heart out without U.S. support. The ground soon shifted as Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with Ukrainian and European negotiators in Geneva and removed nine of the most objectionable points from Russia's plan. Rubio said he was very optimistic about the new 19-point framework, which leaves the final territorial lines open to further negotiation. Zelensky asked to meet directly with Trump as soon as possible to lobby against any land concession to Russia and finalize the amended plan. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said any meaningful changes to understandings reached between Putin and Trump would create a fundamentally different situation. What the columnist said. The only explanation for this confusing series of events is that rival factions within the White House fought over the peace plan and made a mess of it, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Witkoff, Kushner, and Dmitriev essentially laundered a Kremlin Christmas wish list, triggering an uproar. Rubio then told a bipartisan group of senators that the 28-point plan came from Russia and was not the U.S.'s proposal. The Secretary of State worked with Ukrainian and European envoys to shape a proposal that relieves Zelensky and is now endorsing while Moscow scowls. The initial plan realized Ukraine's worst fears, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Once again, Trump was doing Russia's bidding, which became all more obvious when he issued his stark ultimatum to Zelensky. Rubio was the game changer, said Jack Blanchard and Dasha Burns in Politico. When the White House cast the proposal as a fait accompli, he shifted the narrative, insisting Ukraine deserved a say. The longtime Russia hawk then forged a Ukraine-friendly peace proposal in Geneva that he's touting as the best we have in our entire 10 months of working on these issues. Clearly, this ultra-positive message was aimed at a certain audience of one. Zelensky handled Trump shrewdly, showing he's learned since foolishly sparring with him in the Oval Office in February, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Faced with the disastrous Russian plan Trump adopted, he remained calmed and offered to negotiate. But the likely outcome of any plan that denies Putin his main goals is that Russia will fight on no matter the human cost. Trump and Putin hoped that a weakened Zelensky would have to swallow the bad deal, said Yaroslav Trominov in the Wall Street Journal. Rocked by a corruption scandal that has ensnared top ministers and sparked fury across Ukraine, he's on shakier ground politically than at any point during the four-year war. But that makes him actually less likely to give ground in a conflict many Ukrainians view as existential. Despite brutal losses, they are in no mood to surrender. Nor is Putin about to bend, said Paul Stone in the New York Times. He would gladly have taken as a win a Kremlin-friendly peace plan that enshrines Ukraine's perpetual subordination. But he'll also see a failed process as a victory if it leads Trump to pull remaining support for Ukraine. With his economy struggling and his troops mired in a slow advance that's had a steep cost in lives and materiel, Putin's capacity for continued war isn't limitless, but he believes time is on his side, and his goal hasn't shifted. He wants to break Ukraine. And a shorter second main story. Judge dismisses case against Trump adversaries. What happened? President Trump's retribution campaign against his political foes suffered a major loss this week after a federal judge dismissed criminal charges against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. Comey, who investigated Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, was indicted in September for allegedly lying to Congress. And James, who brought a civil fraud case against Trump in 2022, was indicted in October for alleged mortgage fraud. Both have pleaded not guilty. But Judge Cameron McGowan Curry ruled that the prosecutor who brought the charges, Lindsay Halligan, was illegally appointed to her role as interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. Because of Halligan's defective appointment, said Curry, a Bill Clinton appointee, all of her prosecutions must be set aside. Attorney General Pam Bondi said the government will immediately appeal the ruling. Curry dismissed both cases without prejudice, creating a path for the Justice Department to re-indict James, even if it loses its appeal. Comey was indicted just days before the statute of limitations expired in his case, which will complicate any attempt to refile charges against him. Still, the ex-FBI chief said he expects Trump will probably come after me again. Bondi said that Halligan, a former Trump lawyer she designated as a special attorney in October in a bid to save the cases, would remain at Virginia's Eastern District office. Halligan is an excellent U.S. attorney, she said. Shame on them for not wanting her in office. What the columnist said. This is a mini victory for the rule of law, said Kim Well in The Bulwark. Bondi appointed Halligan to replace another acting U.S. attorney, the well-respected Eric Siebert, who was forced out after he refused to bring charges against Comey and James. But that appointment was botched, Curry explained, because Congress grants the executive branch one chance to fill vacant U.S. attorney offices for 120 days, and those 120 days expired under Siebert. Bondi attempted a bunch of cute maneuvers to circumvent this law, but her luck ran out at Curry's bench. The DOJ is now a dysfunctional legal apparatus, said Andrew Patazzi in Axios. Halligan is a former insurance lawyer with no prosecutorial experience, which showed when she blundered on some basic aspects of criminal law. She admitted last week to signing the final Comey indictment without showing it to the full grand jury, and another judge found that she'd misled those jurors about constitutional rights. If Trump really wants to weaponize the DOJ, he'll need legal competence, not just loyalty. That Trump lost these cases on procedural grounds is unsatisfying, said Benjamin Witz in Lawfare. The court didn't hold the DOJ to account for its vindictive prosecutions for Halligan's grotesque abuses of the grand jury process. The sheer paucity of evidence of criminality in either case was also under-addressed. A win is a win, but there's little to celebrate when Trump is free to continue his lawless harassment of his political enemies. Controversy of the week. Vaccines, RFK Jr.'s dangerous autism deception. Our depressing vaccine future just came into focus, said Jessica Gross in the New York Times. After 10 already turbulent months as Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dismayed mainstream scientists and doctors last week when he changed the Centers for Disease Control's website to promote his long-held personal belief that childhood vaccines cause autism. The headline of the relevant webpage still reads, "Vaccines do not cause autism," but with an asterisk and a footnote stating that the claim vaccines do not cause autism is not an evidence-based claim because studies have not ruled out the possibility that infant vaccines cause autism. This was RFK Jr.'s scurrilous way of evading his promise during his confirmation hearings that he would keep the CDC's statement on vaccines and autism. Studies have also not ruled out the possibility that infant vaccines cause tornadoes, said Benjamin Mazur in The Atlantic, because neither science nor logic can prove a negative. But decades of research involving millions of children in multiple countries have found no correlation between vaccines and autism. The CDC should be sharing the reassuring news with anxious parents, not using pretzel logic and pseudoscience to sow bewilderment and doubt. It gets worse, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The CDC's new guidance doesn't just suggest a link between vaccines and autism. It states that studies showing such a link have been ignored by health authorities. This is a baseless slur on the rigor and integrity of bodies like the CDC and the National Institutes of Health, which provide critical guidance to the public. The website changes are just the latest blow to morale at the CDC, said Kira Butler in Mother Jones. Under Kennedy, staff have also seen waves of layoffs and resignations and watched measles case numbers hit their highest level in three decades. With RFK Jr. sowing fear and doubt, childhood vaccination rates may fall below herd immunity levels. It feels like we're on a hijacked plane, said a CDC staffer. Kennedy's not alone in his crusade, said Catherine J. Wu in The Atlantic. NIH Director J. Bhattacharya, an ally of Kennedy's, just published an essay calling the world to rip up its old pandemic playbook and to stop spending billions identifying emerging viruses and creating vaccines. It's more effective, he wrote, to build a healthy population, physically active and eating nutritious food, whose strong immune systems will cope far better in the face of a novel pathogen. This is dangerous nonsense. Millions of young, healthy, active people were killed by the Spanish flu in 1918-20, and by HIV in the 1980s and 90s. Being in better shape offers little protection against a deadly virus our immune systems have never seen. Kennedy's changes to the CDC website could be a harbinger of something worse, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee, now packed with RFK Jr.'s anti-vax soulmates, may soon demand changes to some childhood vaccines that will make them effectively impossible to produce. Kids will get sick, thanks to Kennedy's crackpot theories, and some of them will die, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark. By using once credible agencies to spread deliberate misinformation, RFK Jr. is also attacking the bonds of trust that hold our society together. Like the president who appointed him, this kook is doing damage that will ripple through American society for years. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for owing the means of production after Elon Musk's AI chatbot, Grok, described the tech magnate as strikingly handsome with a lean athletic physique and a genius-level intellect, rivaling polymaths like Da Vinci and Newton. Musk later claimed that Grok had been manipulated by adversarial prompting into saying absurdly positive things about me. It was a good week for Adolf Hitler, who was set to secure a fifth term as distinct administrator in the Namibian region of Umpunda. Adolf Hitler Unona has disowned the Nazis' leader's beliefs and said his father, who gave him the name, was unclear on what Adolf Hitler stood for, but liked the sound of the name. It was a good week for the arts after Semaphore reported that President Trump is pressuring Paramount owner Larry Ellison to revive the 1990s Rush Hour buddy cop movie franchise, which starred Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker and blended martial arts with gags about racial stereotypes. But it was a bad week for MAGA after a new feature on X revealed that some of the top pro-Trump accounts on the platform are not based in the U.S. They include @MAGANationX, which has 400,000 followers and claims to be a patriot voice for we the people, but is actually based in Eastern Europe. It was a bad week for giving after a Fox News guest advised Americans struggling with inflation, tariffs, and rising health care costs that adults don't need gifts this holiday season. Focus on the people in your life who are ages 3 to 18, said financial coach Jade Warshaw. Grandma doesn't need slippers. And it was a bad week for literacy after Austin Siebert, 30, was convicted of smuggling drugs into an Ohio prison by spraying a narcotic solution onto the pages of J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. At trial, prosecutors played audio of Siebert, 30, claiming the vice president's gritty coming-of-age memoir is the book I'm reading, and describing it falsely as a expletive romance novel. And one short and other news piece. Trump admin to review Biden-era refugees. The Trump administration this week revealed plans to conduct a review of all refugees admitted to the U.S. under President Biden, threatening the legal status of nearly 200,000 people. The U.S. has long welcomed refugees fleeing persecution and violence, many of whom wait years to enter. But a memo from Citizen and Immigration Services accused the Biden administration of prioritizing quantity and expediency over detailed screening and vetting. The agency expects to re-interview every refugee who entered the U.S. from January 20th, 2021 to February 20th, 2025. including green card holders, anyone deemed unqualified for refugee status won't have the right to appeal. USCIS is ready to ensure the refugee program is not abused, wrote agency leader Joseph Edlow. The administration has already paused the refugee program, limiting entries to mostly white South Africans. Moving on to the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. A funeral for Cheney and the old GOP. I got a hug from Rachel Maddow at Dick Cheney's funeral, said Susan B. Glasser. In a surreal scene, the crowd that gathered to say goodbye to the divisive former Republican vice president last week included the progressive cable TV host and Democrats Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, Al Gore, Kamala Harris, and Joe Biden. Not there, Republican President Donald Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, or House Speaker Mike Johnson. As Vice President, Cheney's insistent promotion of the Iraq War and unchecked American power made him the most divisive figure in public life until Trump himself. But he followed his daughter, former Representative Liz Cheney, out the door of the GOP after it chose Trump's lies about the election of 2020 over the plain truth of his defeat. The crowd at Cheney's funeral made it clear how sharply MAGA populism has divided traditional Republicans from Trumpists, while making the Cheneys strange bedfellows of Democrats who once loathed them. To see Pelosi, Biden, and Maddow mourning Cheney next to conservative Uber hawk John Bolton was to see old Washington turned on its head. Only in this cursed, bizarre Trumpian present could this realignment be possible. An Orwellian solution for negative data. How do you eradicate hunger, STDs, illiteracy, poverty? Asked Catherine Rampell. Simple. You stop measuring them. The Trump administration has imposed a data blackout on many government statistics used to measure how well we're doing as a nation and how he's doing as a president. The Department of Government Efficiency's cuts have been winnowing the ranks of government number crunchers and quietly snuffing out thousands of other data series, particularly those that might produce politically inconvenient results. President Trump fired the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics in August because of anemic job creation data. The rest of the agency has been Swiss cheesed, with many regional offices shut down. The Bureau of Economic Analysis, which measures GDP, consumer spending, and inflation, is cutting staff by 20%. The administration has canceled a survey measuring food insecurity and eliminated the team that measures poverty and helps determine eligibility for Medicaid, Head Start, and food stamps. Data collection on substance abuse, natural disasters, children's illiteracy, climate change, race, crime, immigration, and other issues has simply ceased. Business and public officials need reliable federal statistics to make decisions. Trump, though, would rather curate his own reality. This column comes from Europe. Ukraine. Corruption puts Zelensky's credibility on the line. The corruption scandal shaking Ukraine looks like something approaching treason, said Marna Deluik Yarmoleva, an espresso from Ukraine. Even as Russian missiles continue to rain down on our power plants, plunging civilians into cold and darkness, two anti-corruption watchdogs have accused government insiders of squeezing $100 million in kickbacks from the state-owned nuclear power operator. The 15-month investigation involving thousands of hours of wiretaps revealed officials openly discussing how to skim from utility projects. At one point, one of them mentions taking $6 million to buy property in Switzerland. When agents raided the homes last month of suspects with code names like Rocket, Tenor, Professor, and Che Guevara, they found satchels filled with cash. That was money that ought to have gone toward protecting energy infrastructure so civilians could survive the winter in minimal comfort. Instead, it went to corrupt officials. This fiasco has explosive implications for President Volodymyr Zelensky, said Denis Trubetskoy in Die Zeit, Germany. The crooks include members of his inner circle. Timur Mendich, the alleged mastermind, helped found the Kvartal 95 TV studio with Zelensky and is still a part owner. Zelensky sold his shares upon becoming president. Mendich escaped to Israel just hours before his home was raided, which suggests he received advance warning. Vowing to severely punish anyone involved, Zelensky forced the resignations of two cabinet members who are under investigation but who have denied wrongdoing. Firing those two is a start, said Thomas de Istria in Le Monde from France, but it's not enough to end the grave crisis of confidence Zelensky faces at home and abroad. When he was elected in 2019 as an outsider with no political experience, his mandate was to put an end to corruption. Yet this summer, he tried to defang the anti-corruption agencies, triggering the first big anti-government protest since the war started. His reputation is now seriously tarnished. As opposition lawmaker Inna Solfsen said, the naked greed is very hard to accept when people are dying on the front lines. The scandal is a gift for Vladimir Putin, said Dagens Nyheter from Sweden in an editorial. The Kremlin's propaganda machine has been trying to distract from Russia's heavy losses by pretending that the corruption has sapped Ukrainians' will to fight. It lost no time in putting out fake videos purporting to show Ukrainian soldiers weeping and laying down their weapons. And after Ukrainian authorities announced that the investigation was looking at nearly a dozen officials, Hungary's Putin-friendly Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, called for a halt to European aid. Orban said European money would be wasted on Zelensky's mafia network. Okay, this looks bad, said Demian Shevko in the New York, the new voice of Ukraine. It shakes the trust of millions who are sacrificing everything while others steal in the shadows. But those saying we are a failed state have it backward. Failed states don't investigate their own ministers during wartime. They don't publish damning evidence against the president's powerful friends. Corruption, a cancer inherited from our Soviet past, thrives in darkness. Ukraine is exposing it to daylight. And daylight, even when it burns, is the beginning of healing. Time for the last word, our feature article. Addicted to the auto pen. From the White House to Capitol Hill, Washington relies on auto pens, said Nancy Scola in Washingtonian. How did a device that replicates signatures become so essential and so contentious? Quality autographs bought and sold, reads the business card Ed Bomsey hands me in his basement office in Northern Virginia. It's an obsession, he tells me, that began in the mid-1960s on the Bronx campus of New York University. Newly elected to the student government, Bomsey found an old letter declining an invitation to visit. I said, "Hey guys, we have this from Harry Truman," he recalls. One guy said, "Take it." Bomsey did. Today he still treasures that letter, secure in the knowledge that the signature on it came directly from the former president's hand. Truman, Bomsey explains, did not use an auto pen. A mechanical device capable of faithfully replicating a person's signature, the auto pen has been used by every president since. Lately, it's been the subject of considerable controversy. Joe Biden is facing multiple investigations and the ongoing scorn of his successor, Donald Trump, for using an auto pen to sign scores of pardons and commutations in his final days of office. And Biden is hardly the first president to take flak for the practice. In 1965, famed philographer Charles Hamilton rocked the autograph world when he pulled back the curtain on John F. Kennedy's auto penning in a scathing book titled "The Robot That Helped to Make a President." A decade later, Hamilton described the auto pen as an accursed device. "For us collectors and dealers, it is," Bomsey says. Indeed, only wet signature documents make the Wall of Fame in his home office, the centerpiece of which is a government appointment marked with George Washington's signature, featuring a distinctive small circle floating above the period after his first initial of G. "I told my wife," Bomsey says, "if the house catches fire, grab that first." In a city defined by power and the endless paperwork that power produces, presidents aren't alone in relying on auto pens. But who exactly uses the machines, and for what kinds of documents, is something Bomsey calls one of the best-kept secrets in Washington. He pulls out a thick white binder, dropping it on his coffee table with a heavy thunk. This is his encyclopedia, a compendium of auto pen samples compiled over decades. Inside are letters from a who's who of American political history, including Robert F. Kennedy, former Cabinet Secretary George Romney, and even Martin Luther King Jr. There's a flourish-filled signature from Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. There are signed headshots aplenty, one of them from Jody Powell, press secretary in the Carter White House. "Why would you need an auto pen? Having your own," Bomsey says, "is a sign of prestige." And for the auto pen, it seems no job is too small. Bomsey hands me a typewritten note. It looks like an informal message between friends. "Nancy and I," the note begins, "are still laughing over that Carter joke." Bomsey points at the Ronald Reagan sign-off at the button. "That's machine." During his presidency, Thomas Jefferson was an early user of the newfangled polygraph, an auto pen precedent that connected two writing instruments and allowed users to make a copy of a document as they crafted it. "I could not now, therefore, live without the device," he wrote. It wasn't until World War II, however, that automating signatures became government practice. To help the Navy quicken the pace of production, a 21-year-old machinist at Alexandria's Naval Torpedo Factory named Robert DeChavo Jr. made the first commercially successful auto pen, modernizing the design of a 1930s device called the robot pen. For busy officials in a rapidly growing bureaucracy, the device was a godsend. Leaving the war effort, DeChavo bought the company that had created the Robert pen and renamed it the International Auto Pen Company. Following DeChavo's death in 1994, tax issues and business conflicts eventually led his children to splitting from the firm, now known as DeMillick, and starting a competitor, automated signature technology. Today, the two companies are housed in remarkably similar two-story office parks alongside automotive shops in D.C. suburbs, one in Rockville, Maryland, the other in Sterling, Virginia, 40-minute drive apart. The companies have engaged in a long-running battle over who gets to use the term AutoPen, a fight that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has declined to resolve. I reached out to both companies. Neither wanted to talk. When I mentioned this to Bomsey, he wasn't surprised. No one, he says, wants to be outed as an AutoPen user, especially not government clients. Insofar as they're concerned, he says of the firms, lifting his hands and shrugging, it's don't know what you're talking about. Though AutoPens are everywhere in Washington, officials are loath to discuss their use. In his book, Hamilton quotes Kennedy Press Secretary Pierre Salinger, horrified by the notion that anyone other than the president was in command, exclaiming, there is no such machine. Bill Clinton's director of letters and messages once said that the presidential AutoPen was the second most guarded thing in the White House after the president. Despite their aura of mystery, AutoPens aren't much to look at. Picture a desktop printer sprouting a pair of spider-like metal arms connected like an accordion, which come together to hold a pen. In the past, machines relied on plexiglass templates to mimic signatures. Today, many AutoPens use USB drives or credit card-sized plastic cards to store signatures, and they're capable of holding a wide variety of pens. Modern machines, which reportedly cost $2,000 to $10,000 and can produce up to 500 signatures an hour, also let users deploy a variety of templates. A more loosely written nickname for personal correspondence, or a tighter signature with a middle initial for more formal documents. Rakin reportedly had 22 different signature templates, including Ron and Dutch. In 2011, Barack Obama made history when he became the first president, as far as we know, to use an AutoPen to sign a bill into law. He was in Europe at the time, and the Patriot Act needed to be extended immediately. To comply with the law, Obama relied on a legal opinion from George W. Bush administration, which said that it was fine for presidents to use the device to sign bills, with one condition. We emphasize that we are not suggesting that the president may delegate the decision to approve and sign a bill, only that having made this decision, he may direct a subordinate to affix the president's signature to the bill, the opinion reads. Not everyone was happy. Tom Graves, a Republican House member from Georgia, asked Obama to confirm that he'd actually read the text of the bill before his staff fired up the robot pen. Graves also tried to give the White House homework, asking the president to explain in writing his constitutional authority to delegate bill signing to a machine. This wasn't a novel way to try to score political points. Historically, suggesting that staffers were running wild with the AutoPen has been a way of branding their bosses as asleep at the wheel. In 1980, North Carolina Republican Senator Jesse Helms chided President Carter over a letter he had sent to the leader of Panama on the future of the Panama Canal. The missive was so misguided, Helms said on the Senate floor, that the only explanation was that someone in the bowels of the State Department just put some boilerplate language and sent it to the White House and then used the AutoPen and signed the president's name to it, and there it went. Sometimes such scenarios are uncomfortably close to the truth. 1989, an executive assistant at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Deborah Gordine, was investigated by Congress over allegedly running the agency under an indifferent secretary via AutoPen. Dean was eventually convicted of conspiracy to defraud the government. government officials have, very occasionally, attempted to curb auto pen use. In 2015, Senator John McCain, upset over delays in the Navy's delivery of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, inserted into a defense spending bill a requirement that the Secretary of Navy personally sign off on any further changes, not auto pen. Mostly, though, the instrument's use has continued unabated. Occasionally, this creates a temptation to blame it on the machines. Vice President Dan Quayle once faulted an auto pen wielding staffer for signing off on a letter requesting better treatment for an incarcerated GOP donor. Usually, though, officials abide by a Washington norm. Own thy auto pen. In 1984, New York Times columnist William Sapphire confronted Secretary of Commerce Malcolm Baldrige over an in-house writing guide Sapphire found tendentious. "Did I write that?" Sapphire recalled Baldrige saying. Told his signature was on the document, the Commerce Secretary sighed. "If it came out of my shop, I'm responsible," said Baldrige. "Sock it to me." Just by their physical nature, handwritten signatures make an implicit statement. I was here. I approved what's written. In politics, that packs a punch. On the bottom of a bar tab, John Hancock's oversized signature could be read as evidence of main character syndrome. On the Declaration of Independence, written on the face of an antagonistic British crown, it reads more like an exclamation point. Sock it to me, King George. In his JFK book, Charles Hamilton fretted about the loss of that magic. And worse, long before the introduction of ChatGPT, he warned darkly of the transfer of man's functions to the oiled gears of a machine, imagining a White House in which an auto pen could create a fabrication so perfect that it would pass as authentic in any court of law. Such a robot could sign a document which might plunge the nation into war. Such a robot would sign mandates if the president were indisposed or absent, or if he died and the news of his death were withheld. Such a robot could be a terrifying weapon in the hands of unauthorized persons. It's easy to dismiss efforts to probe Biden's auto pen as bad faith weapons of partisan warfare, especially when Trump, an admitted user of the machine, continues to deride his predecessor as the auto pen president and has gone so far as to decorate a White House presidential walk of fame featuring portraits of every former commander-in-chief with an image of a robot signing Biden's name. But there are others who believe presidential auto pen use should be curbed in some cases, regardless of which party is controls the White House. In the spring, Georgia Republican Representative Buddy Carter introduced a single-line bill, the Signature Integrity for Granting National Pardons Act, that simply states the president shall personally sign any pardon or reprieve. Still, despite Republican efforts to make hay out of Biden, there's never been an auto pen Watergate, a crisis large enough to create change. During the Iraq War, veterans and lawmakers criticized Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld for using the machine to sign letters sent to family members of troops killed in action. He promised to stop, and that was that. Day after day, year after year, in offices all over the city, robot arms scribble away without incident. Perhaps D.C.'s supposed auto pen problem isn't much of a problem in the first place. There has to be some degree of delegation to staff members in a congressional office or an executive office, said Chris Miller, professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. The job is too big. For all the hush-hush surrounding auto pen use in Washington, the real secret is no secret at all. Like Jefferson, the city can't live without it. The machine is simply too useful. Back in his office, Ed Bomsey flips through his collection of robot-written signatures. The names go on and on. Secretary of Agriculture Orville Friedman, General George C. Marshall, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. As a collector, Bomsey is pained by all of this. But as a former lawyer who spent time in D.C.'s policy trenches, he's sympathetic. "It's the burden of the office," he says. "You're doing the best you can." This was adapted from an article that first appeared in Washingtonian. Here's one of the business columns for you. Bitcoin, crypto's surprise collapse rattles markets. "This was supposed to be crypto's year," said Kevin T. Dugan and Vicky Gi Huang in the Wall Street Journal. Favorable legislation put a close to more than a decade of antagonistic U.S. regulation and prosecutions. Wall Street got in the game. And crypto gained allies inside the White House with President Trump, a one-time skeptic, pledging to make the U.S. a Bitcoin superpower as his family business launched its own stablecoin and digital currency. This perfect storm took crypto to new heights until it crashed. In a stunning turnabout, more than $1 trillion has been wiped out from the cryptocurrency market since mid-October. Fueled by a shocking plunge in the price of Bitcoin, which briefly dropped below $81,000 last week, after reaching an all-time high of $126,000 in early October, it is now on pace for its first annual loss since 2022. "A whirlwind of factors is behind the fall," said Medora Lee in USA Today. "Cryptocurrency, which has no intrinsic value, tends to trade in line with the riskier growth stocks, and they have also seen pullbacks as concerns grow about an artificial intelligence bubble." Other analysts trace the downfall to October 10th and Trump's surprise tariff announcement against China, which wiped out an estimated $19 billion in leveraged crypto positions. It was a wake-up call for many Bitcoin bulls. "Trump has also had a hand in dragging crypto into the swamp," said Lionel Laurent in Bloomberg. "His family wealth has swelled thanks to opportunistic crypto ventures worth more than $1 billion, while ordinary Americans struggle. Other moves, such as pardoning of Binance chief executive Changpeng Zhao, with whom his family does business, complete the picture of a digital gilded age. Voters have noticed. In New York City, they elected Zoram Mamdani over the crypto-backed Andrew Cuomo. Investors may now be dumping Bitcoin out of fear that a Democratic sweep in the midterms could slam the brakes on pro-crypto policies. The plunge has triggered a vague PTSD flashback to Bitcoin's crypto winter, said Charlie Garcia in MarketWatch. But let's be clear. In 2022, people sold crypto because they were scared following the exposure of several high-profile frauds. In 2025, people are selling because they're rich. It's a big difference. I equate what's unfolding now to what you see after an IPO when the insiders are finally allowed to sell. They do so because they can, not because they think the business is doomed. Now we have SEC-approved Bitcoin exchange-traded funds that make it possible to move billions without knocking the price off the table. And that's exactly what's happening. Crypto fire sales shouldn't be taken lightly, said The Economist. Mainstream finance embracing crypto means it's no longer insulated from other market trends. In fact, the biggest risk of all is that miserable sentiment in cryptocurrency spreads to other markets, P particularly bonds. That interconnection can be helpful too, said Katie Martin in Financial Times. The big beast of crypto is now mainstream investors' go-to barometer of vibes and speculative exuberance, and is especially useful as an early warning system that markets are unwell. Perhaps Bitcoin has a purpose after all. And we flip over to the talking points page. We'll start with MTG, what her exit means for MAGA. The ultimate MAGA warrior just laid down her sword and limped home, said Robert Draper in the New York Times. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia, unexpectedly resigned last week, announcing her final day in Congress will be January 5th, a year before her term ends. Elected in 2020 as a proponent of the QAnon movement and other far-right conspiracy theories, she became one of President Trump's most reliable attack dogs. But in recent months, Greene's loyalty has wavered. She defied the administration by opposing military aid for Israel, raising the alarm over expiring Obamacare subsidies during the shutdown, and relentlessly demanding the release of the Epstein files. She even apologized for her past contributions to toxic politics. Fed up with Greene's apostasies, Trump attacked her on social media as a traitor and threatened to back a primary challenger. Feeling betrayed by Trump and terrified by the subsequent flood of death threats against her and her family, Greene announced her resignation, saying it was driven by disillusionment and was not part of a politically calculated 4D chess game on her part. This may not be the end of Greene's odd, cranky political career, said the Wall Street Journal in editorial. Her resignation video resembled a populist stump speech, possibly a preview of a 2028 presidential run, in which she warned that she and many common Americans were being cast aside by a president who is more focused on the interests of big tech, foreign leaders, and the elite donor class. Whether or not she runs, she's already hit upon the likely theme of the next race, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. She has argued that the nation's leaders have been negligent in assessing Americans' most basic needs, health care, housing, feeding their kids, and financing college. It's a powerful back-to-basics message and one that resonates far beyond the MAGA movement. Greene's resignation proves that Trump's wrath remains the most powerful force in Washington, said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. Few, if any, GOP lawmakers can survive his direct and baleful gaze. But while Trump can tighten his grip on legislators he's lashed to his agenda and personal brand, Greene's resistance and resignation also show that the movement Trump created, one that stretches from the mainstream right to the apolitical lumpen proletariat, is shredding and fraying. More pieces of the populist masses are falling from his hands. Trump can claim, "I am MAGA," but an entire herd of successors, smelling weakness, are prepared to disagree. The military, when is an order illegal? Trump is unraveling, said Brian Karam in Salon. The president last week posted an unhinged rant in which he called a group of six Democratic legislators traitors and accused them of engaging in seditious behavior punishable by death. The legislators, who each served in the U.S. military or the intelligence community, had released a video reminding military officials that they had an obligation to refuse illegal orders from the commander-in-chief. In their statement, Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin, former CIA officer, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, retired Navy fighter pilot and NASA astronaut, and four House members said the administration was pitting our uniformed military and intelligence community professionals against American citizens, and reminded these officials that they had taken an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, not the president. After Trump posted his inflammatory ravings, the Pentagon announced that it was investigating Kelly as a retired officer for possible breaches of military law. No question, Trump is an unhinged rageaholic, said Jim Garrity in National Review. But the lawmakers in the video didn't specify any solid and recent examples of the president giving illegal orders. When a Fox News host asked Colorado Representative Jason Crow, one of the video's participants, for examples, he went back 5 years to Trump asking if soldiers could shoot Black Lives Matter protesters in the legs. That question, while alarming, was not an order. Perhaps not, but there's very strong recent evidence of illegal commands, said Greg Sargent in the New Republic. A top military lawyer reportedly warned that President's bombings of supposed drug smugglers in the Caribbean is likely to be illegal. He was shunted aside, but Admiral Alvin Halsey, who oversaw naval operations in the area, resigned due to concerns that the strikes rested on shaky legal grounds. Trump has put our military in an impossible situation, said David French. As a former military lawyer myself, I am hearing from anguished current service people involved in the Caribbean attacks, and they feel real moral doubt and profound legal confusion. How do individual service members know which orders are illegal? They often can't, which is why the responsibility for that judgment belongs high in the military chain of command. Sadly for our nation and our sailors and soldiers, Trump is making the military's most senior leaders complicit in his unlawful acts. Well, folks, with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.